Right, the reading today is taken from John 7, verses 25 to 36. And if you have one of the church Bibles, that's page 1077. So that's page 1077, John 7, verses 25 to 36. Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, "Is not this the man whom they seek to kill? And here he is, speaking openly, and they do nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know where this man comes from, and when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from." So Jesus proclaimed, as he taught in the temple, "You know me, and you know where I come from, but I have not come of my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. I know him, for I have come from him, and he sent me." So they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. And many of the people believed in him. They said, "When the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done?" The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. Jesus then said, "I will be with you a little longer, and then I am going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come." The Jews said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go, that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach Greeks? What does he mean by saying, 'You will seek me and you will not find me,' and 'Where I am, you cannot come'?"
Thanks, Tony, very much indeed. Keep your Bible open there in John chapter 7. That would be helpful. Just to introduce myself to you if you're new, if you're visiting us this evening. My name's Tim Davis, and I'm the overall leader here at Christchurch Central. It's good to welcome you, and good to perhaps talk with you at the end as well, if you're new, if you're visiting, to let you know a little bit more about us as a church. This little passage we're looking at tonight is quite humbling, and have that in your mind, ready to the Bible here to be quite challenging, perhaps about the way you think or your attitudes. I certainly have found it quite challenging indeed. I'm a bit of a latecomer, but an increasingly a fan of The Simpsons. It really is only in the last few weeks that I've kind of got into it, as our children, particularly our son, has really got to wanting to watch it at 6 o'clock every single evening. And typical kind of dad, I prefer the 6 o'clock news if that's what you're going to be watching it then. But I'm kind of like swinging that way towards finding The Simpsons a lot more attractive than the news. But we're still trying to have our evening meal together. Don't get me wrong; it's not completely become an idol yet. But Homer says this infamous grace that Homer has before the evening meal, Most of us kind of, perhaps in our culture, wouldn't be as blunt as Homer Simpson, but he kind of like, I guess, summarises a pervasive attitude that there is there in our culture. He sits down and he says his grace. He says, "Dear God, we paid for this ourselves, so thanks for nothing." I guess that's, who's really doing the harvest celebration at the moment? I mean, a lot of rural church. I used to be a part of the leadership of a church in rural Oxfordshire. This is the time when the kind of the church was filled with bits of wheat and barley and beautiful flowers and freshly baked bread and thousands of tins of baked beans and that sort of thing. Here we are today, and we look at John's Gospel. We find ourselves entering a very, very different world, because the context of it is a harvest celebration, and people spending a whole week just giving thanks to God. It's interesting actually that the celebration that the Jews were having in their calendar actually has carried on, and it started yesterday. This Feast of Tabernacles or Tents, And it's just interesting having Mike standing up earlier on and saying, well, actually, we're in Canada. This is Thanksgiving time. And he stood here in front of us a moment ago and just shared some of the things that he and Corey are really thankful to God for in their lives over the last year or 2 years. It certainly does carry on this sense of gratitude to God, but it tends perhaps across our culture to be, well, you know, what do you want to thank God for? Thanks for nothing, we did it ourselves. So we enter this Feast of Booths, Tabernacles, or Feast of Tents, whatever however you want to describe it. This whole nation of Israel is celebrating this moment of thanking God. They actually spent, the reason why it's called the Feast of Tabernacles or Tents or Booths is they kind of like spent a week camping. Not for fun. I know some people do that sort of thing for fun. But they went off to do it just to help them remember way back in history when they had been rescued by God from slavery. And God took them across the wilderness where they camped for 40 years each day into the promised land. And so it kind of helped them to remember God's rescue of them in the past and God's provision when he rescued them. So they went through the desert and God had provided water for them and he had provided food for them. One particular way that God demonstrated his presence with them was by this huge great big pillar of cloud, which was right in there amongst them during the day. And when the cloud moved, they packed up the tents and followed the cloud. It was, you know, God's presence with them through the cloud by day. And in the night, it was a great pillar of fire. And so at the Feast of Booths, what they would do, they would get some great big candles and they would light these candles, helping them to remember God's presence with them. This is the God who provides. This is the God who rescues. This is the God who is present. The light was to remind them of this pillar of fire, the light with them in the desert. Well, all the all that kind of Bible background rattling around in the mind of John as he writes his book, as his listeners and his first readers read it, when it comes to Jesus arriving in Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles, which is all about tenting, and that word has already been used in John's Gospel about God tabernacling, tenting, dwelling amongst us. Here is Jesus, who is God dwelling with his people, and he's arrived at the time of light when the pillar of fire, and that's already been referred to in John chapter 1 as well, Jesus, the light of the world. Well, John's being very plain about who Jesus is. We ask, who is this Jesus? And John kind of said, well, he's the light of the world. He's God. God's present with his people. Here he is, present with his people. The light of the world. So John, it's kind of obvious, really. It's clear. It would be clear to anyone reading John's Gospel with their understanding of the past history and the Old Testament section of the Bible. But even actually to quite a few people around Jesus then, they didn't get who Jesus was. They didn't have a clue. They were struggling and had all sorts of uncertainties, and I guess that amongst us in a group of folks that there are here amongst us this evening, I guess there's plenty of folks here who still are wondering, who is this Jesus? We just sung the song a moment ago, who do you say I am? And we're kind of singing, where's you the Messiah? And there may be folks here who think, well, actually, I don't know if you're the Messiah. I don't even know what that word means. And so actually this little section of John is very relevant to you. It's relevant if you already know who the Messiah is. And like I said, be ready for something that might be a little bit challenging or humbling. You see, are you seriously interested in answering that question, who is Jesus? Look at verse 24, just before our little section begins. Verse 24, Jesus has this challenge to judge with right judgment. The assumption is that you can judge with wrong judgment. You can get it wrong. You can get Jesus wrong. You can misjudge who Jesus is. And in the two little sections that we had read for us a moment ago by Tony, there are basically, it seems to me, two main wrong judgments, two misunderstandings about Jesus. Misjudgment number one is this. All I see of Jesus is all there is. Now, all I understand of him is really enough for me to make a good conclusion of that he's satisfactory. All I see is all there is. And it is quite an arrogant statement, isn't it? Yet I think the challenge is actually to us all is that it's actually quite a remarkably common stance that most of us take. I don't know, I mean, if we were really, really honest and just picked up various subjects and topics and themes that are around in our culture and in the media at the moment and asked us our opinion, we'd probably have an opinion. But then if we asked us, why do you have that opinion? Well, it's probably because of hearsay or third or fourth hand information. And we've made our view, all I see is all there is. I've got enough, but I've come to a conclusion. But when you dig a bit deeper, it's actually, we don't actually have that much information at all. I think we do it all the time. My children, well, when my children have a bust up, we're a reasonably normal family, that happens every so often. And when my children have a bust up, and when I see with my own eyes A hit B, B gets punished pretty swiftly. And B cries out, it's not fair. And B is right, because A has been winding B up for about an hour. But I've misjudged. All I saw, I concluded, was all there is. And the result was misjudgment, and it was unfair. That's a very common thing that happens in our family. I misjudge because I assume that all I see is all there is. But it's not all there is. Now, there was a TV ad in which a tough skinhead robs a woman, asking various people this week if they remember what that advertisement was. If you remember what it was, then you let me know. But it's a tough kind of looking guy robs a skinhead, the skinhead kind of robs this woman of a handbag. And in the process, you know, she's thrown to the floor, the pavement. And then the cameras move around and the film is rerun again, the advert's rerun again, from a wider angle, and you realise that he's not robbing her at all. He's actually rescuing her from a great pile of bricks that's falling from the building side above. And the kind of advert is, all you see is all there is. Well, no, I think there's a newspaper advert. Take a bigger view. And I think we're often guilty of it when we come to God and when we come to Jesus. He's there in history. No one would deny that. But do we actually see the fuller picture of who he is? Or have we decided upon him with a limited understanding? Are we prejudiced when it comes to him? That's what I'm really asking. And I think John's Gospel challenges us on. See, Jesus was causing a bit of a stir in Jerusalem. People were asking, who is this Jesus? Is he the Christ? Is he, that is, the Son of God? Is he God's King? You see, last time Jesus was in town, in Jerusalem there, he had healed a man on the Sabbath. That's just back in chapter 5. Just flick back and you'll see where, page 1073, the healing of the pool of, on the Sabbath. And Jesus had healed this fellow on the Sabbath. That was against the law. And the religious authorities were very, very angry with him. But here he is in Jerusalem. He's speaking in public in chapter 7. And no one's lifted a finger to do anything against him. So the crowds are beginning to think, well, okay, one minute the authorities are really uptight with him, and now they're not arresting him, no one's lifting a finger, he's out there in public doing his stuff, so perhaps the authorities know something that the rest of us don't know. Maybe he is the Son of God. Verse 25-26, some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is not this the man whom they seek to kill? And here he is, speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? See what's going on there? But so no sooner has the kind of thought entered the mind, and it's kind of gone. The possibility, could be the Christ. As soon as they thought it, it's gone. Now Jesus can't be God's King. Why? Well, the Messiah is supposed to come out of nowhere. He's supposed to be a bit of a surprise. And there was a rabbinic saying apparently that said three things come unexpectedly: the Messiah, a godsend, and a scorpion. And so you kind of think, well, it's kind of, if everyone's throwing language like that around, then is Jesus a bit too obvious for that? We know where he's from. We know he's from Nazareth. We know his dad, Joseph. You know, he's not a big enough surprise. That's what verse 27 says. But we know where this man comes from. And when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. So they kind of added up all their information, and we've made our minds up. This is the information we've got, and we can draw a conclusion. He's not the Christ, with the information we've got. Well, Jesus cries out in response there in verses 28 and 29. You think you know me and where I come from? You haven't got a clue. I wasn't even born in Nazareth. Nazareth is picked up back in chapter 1. There seems to be a bit of a thing, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? I wasn't even born there. That's the thing that's batting around, though not mentioned specifically here, is that Jesus come from the wrong place. Joseph? Am I Joseph's son? You haven't a clue who God is, says Jesus to these folks. And you don't know who God is, and you wouldn't know who his son was if you fell over him while he was, tripped over him while he was sunbathing in the park. You ain't got a clue. That's 28:29. So Jesus proclaimed, as he taught in the temple, you know me, and you know where I come from, but I've not come of my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. You don't know God in heaven. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me. You don't know. So Jesus really is the one who's come from outside. He is God's son, not Joseph's son. He comes from heaven, not from Nazareth. Well, actually, some people did begin to believe in Jesus at this point. Look on at verse 31. No doubt seen there or heard about the feeding of the 5,000. That's back in chapter 6. And they come to begin to get a bigger picture of who Jesus is. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? That sounds pretty good, actually. Yeah, when it comes to signs and miracles, this guy's actually doing it. Could anyone do anything better than this guy? Perhaps he is. So they're beginning to get the picture. But John is overall saying to, I think, to the interested inquirer, to someone reading the gospel, he's really saying, don't write Jesus off on the basis of your own opinion, on the basis of your prejudice or partial knowledge, because just because you think something doesn't make it true or doesn't make it right. It's why the questions that we having are good ones to ask if someone has drawn a conclusion about Jesus and is saying, well, yeah, he's just a good man, or, you know, just a nice fella, a bit of a, you know, healer. Well, to actually say, well, on what do you base your opinion? Now, when was the last time you read John's Gospel or Matthew's Gospel or Mark, these records of Jesus' life? When was the last time you did that? That's a good question to ask, isn't it? I mean, what do we base our decisions on who Jesus is on? It seems that others are beginning to perhaps see the bigger picture. John is pointing out to us that there are some, and when they see some people are beginning to believe in Jesus, need to start taking action. The religious authorities begin to close it down, so that their minds aren't open really to who Jesus is. Their minds are closed, they're narrow. So look at the verse 30 there. So they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him. So it kicks some into gear to arrest them. Let's lead you by a little one. Rich is over there if you need Dad later. So that's I think the first misjudgment of Jesus. Thinking that all we see of him is all there is. And it's good to ask ourselves, well, what do we base our opinion of Jesus? Is it from what we've read in the Bible? and not even engage with that? Could we really draw our conclusions? Well, here's the second misjudgment. The second misjudgment is all I plan concerning God and how much God fits in my life concerning Jesus Christ and the impact that he has upon me, all I plan reference Jesus will come about. You know, I'm sticking in my way and Jesus will fit in this way or that way or not at all. And, you know, I've made my conclusions on who he is and he won't have a part to play at all. Well, this actually, I mean, it sounds as arrogant as the first judgment or misjudgment. But again, I think it's incredibly common. See, I think, just thinking about the way that we plan for the future. I was talking to someone earlier on today, just over lunch, about how, you know, life can suddenly change. And all the things that you've been living on and basing your life for a while can actually, the earth can move a little bit beneath you, can't it? And suddenly raises all sorts of questions. You realise you're not really in control anymore when you once thought you were. See, when I dream about the future and make plans, I have genuine uncertainties. You know, 4 and a bit years ago, I was asked to lead this church, which has ended up being you, but then it was just me and my wife and 4 kids and didn't have a clue where it was heading. And I had all sorts of dreams, and I got to absolutely admit, there were genuine uncertainties. And as I look to the future, I still do have genuine uncertainties. But, what if it doesn't work out? What do I do then? You're like a prize to win. But I'd be lying as well if I didn't say that my uncertainty isn't often matched by an equal amount of confidence. You see, that's why I did it. Because I did have a sense of confidence that it was the right thing to do. I didn't just go, oh, we're never going to, and I'm so worried, and let's not do nothing. So I do have a fair amount of self-confidence. Now, I might have a little bit more self-confidence than some others here. I think there are people in the room who've got a bucket load more self-confidence than I have. But basically, I think all of us have a sense of self-confidence to a certain degree. And we often use that self-confidence when it comes to our opinion of God. We might have all sorts of uncertainties about the future, but when it comes to God, we can write him off without, you know. Now, you'll never play a part in my future, God. Oh, yeah? Sure about that? Where I think this all I plan will come about syndrome really hits home is when things don't turn out as planned. You know, what are the emotions that hit you when something has gone wrong? You know, yeah, we can have a sense of frustration, sometimes we can feel angry. But often, I think for us all, that in that rich mixture of emotions when something goes wrong in our lives, there is a sense of humility. When things go wrong, we do we not, feel humbled. Don't you feel that? If things don't work out, I feel humbled. Oh, just a little illustration. Going back to our summer holidays, we left our little camp, two-thirds of the way down France, it felt like. We left really early in the morning. We headed all the way up. We hit, shot through Paris. We got to Calais about 12 noon. Because we wanted to hit an earlier ferry. We were booked on at the 5 o'clock ferry. When we got there, we queued up with all these other people who were coming back to England. We get to the front of the queue and, you know, it's always happened before. You turn up early, you get onto the earliest ferry. You don't have to wait. This time I hand over the passports and the tickets, and the guy behind the counter says, sorry, can't get on this ferry. Now, what about the next one, an hour's time? No, that's full too. And the one after that? No, that's full too. So you mean we've got to stick with the 5 o'clock ferry then, have we? Yeah. So a great bunch of cars queuing up behind us, and it's all gated, isn't it, with cameras everywhere. What do you do? And I was kind of thinking, well, they've got to put me on because they can't set, there's no way of getting back out. Oh, yes, there is. Push the little button, as gates all move aside, and you're the one Wally. The one prize to it. Oh, has to go out. And everyone's looking, oh, what's wrong with him? Eh? Humbling. Humbling. Frustrating, yet humbling. Plans didn't work out. It's the same when more serious things happen as well, isn't it? you know, bereavement strikes. In amongst all the sadness and the pain, ask anyone who's bereaved, and they will say, yes, they feel humbled. A serious illness comes, amongst all the other things that happen, pride goes out the window. When you're lying on the hospital bed and a bunch of folks are doing stuff to you, and it happens to be August when all the green doctors are on, and they seem to know as much as you. Whatever else happened, it's humbling. Humbling. You see, all the way through our lives, for months, for years, we operate on the assumption that we're in control. What I plan will happen. We basically live that way. From the small things to the bigger things. We kind of like live like our destiny is in our own hands. You know, if the great song had been sung by someone who'd met me, it'd have sung, "I did it Tim's way." I come back to John's Gospel here. The religious authorities saw the positive response Jesus was gaining back there in verse 31. They were stung into trying to take action against him there back in there in verse 30, and then into verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. So they're taking control of the situation. It's beginning to get, this Jesus is getting out of their control. And so no, they're going to take control again. We're going to send in the troops now and arrest him. Well, they didn't get very far. Look on at verse 45 and verse 46 on the next column there. The officers, when they came to the chief priests and Pharisees, they said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" The officers answered, "No one ever spoke like this man." Now, just that their plans didn't work out. They sent the best men, and these guys come back empty-handed. The religious authorities made their plans, but they didn't work out when it came to Jesus. And back there in verse 25, people are asking, aren't they, well, you know, why don't they arrest him? Well, it was not for want of trying. They want to get their hands on this Jesus. He's upsetting the apple cart. But why can't they do that? The reason they cannot do it is because they are not in control. And John is very, very clear about that as he tells us. Look at verse 30. So they were seeking to arrest Jesus, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. They weren't in control. God was in control. God's everlasting. He's the one who's absolutely sovereign in charge of the whole world and the universe, if he's God. That's what's being said here. The religious authorities were not in control. No one was going to touch Jesus until it was God's time. It is a big mistake to think that we are in control of our own destiny. If you are an interested inquirer into Christianity, John, I think it would encourage you to keep on building a better picture of Jesus. And that's why he wrote his gospel. Turn on to the end. I know some folks here will know this pretty well, but others here I will have never seen this before. So turn just to page 1093, chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. John tells us why he's written his book. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So keep on reading, John would say. Keep going. But as you do it, don't be under any illusions. If it's God you're investigating, if God is God, then he, not you, is in control. Even of your investigation of Jesus and how you're already beginning to relate to him. It calls for humility, doesn't it? That's why I said this is very, very humbling. If we're going to start taking Jesus seriously, there's going to come a point when we're going to have to accept him as our king and as God's son. And way back here, as we start to investigate him, there's the call to actually start thinking, right, well, if that's the way I'm heading, I better start being humble in the process now. It is challenging, isn't it? So we must venture on in humility. It's a big mistake to think we're in control of our own destiny. It's foolish to think that we can decide upon God. I mean, sometimes we live our lives like God's on the end of our leash. It's just ludicrous, isn't it? Me, to decide upon God's Son and who he is? You know, when as the Bible unfolds, in actual fact, we're all heading towards God's judgment when he decides upon us. That's the way around it is with God, isn't it? If God's God and we're his creatures. Some people say, oh, I'll think about Christianity when I'm a bit older. Well, how long do you plan living for and how much control do you have on that? Some people say, oh, I'll think about Jesus when I'm a little bit less busy with work or my family. So you've already decided that your family and the immediate and your busyness now is more important than eternity and God? How have you come to that conclusion? Is it wise? And some will say, I can't believe God will reject me. Well, why not? That might be true, but what do you base that assumption? Did you really think that you're in control of your own destiny? That when you get to face God, that he is in the remit of your control, and that you've decided now that he won't reject you, therefore when you get there, you're in control, you've made up your mind, he won't. Like Crocodile Dundee, me and God, we'd be mates, because his mates when he came to earth were all fishermen like me. I refuse to believe in God, in a God who allows suffering. That's really common, and life can be desperately painful. It is, and that's a seriously good question. But does God simply disappear because he doesn't fit our opinion? That's what it ultimately comes down to. The timing of Jesus' departure and Jesus himself was not in the hands of the religious authorities, but God's. Jesus came from the Father and he's returning to the Father, and there's nothing they can do about it. God is not on the end of their leash. They must submit to the authority of God and the one above. Verse 33 and verse 34. Jesus then said, I will be with you a little longer, and then I am going to him who sent me. You will seek me and you won't find me. Where I am, you cannot come. It's pretty damning, isn't it? See, misjudging Jesus has consequences. Verse 35, the Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go, that we will not find him? Does he intend going on a journey, to go travelling, going on tour, to the dispersion among the Greeks, and to teach the Greeks? He's going on a teaching tour. What does he mean by saying, you will seek me and you will not find me, and where I am you cannot come? Wrong conclusions and misjudgments of Jesus lead to confusion. And yet these guys are perfectly comfortable with getting it wrong. Perfectly happy in their confusion. After all, they're right. It's their opinion. Well, as I just draw to a close, I think it is very, very challenging indeed. It's very humbling, I think, this little couple of paragraphs in John's Gospel. They're very, very challenging too. Just the way that we live our lives, isn't it? Just for those of us here who, yes, we are Christians, we describe ourselves as that. We've come to believe Jesus is Lord, come to believe he is the Son of God. Sometimes we can live our lives where we kind of like paddle around in the shallows of taking Jesus seriously. Can we do it? Finally, you can do that for weeks, months, years. I believe Jesus is the Son of God, but does that really fit into the weight that he has in my life? Does he really affect the way that, I pray to him? The way that I relate to other people at work? The way that I trust him for the future? How much of an impact, if he's the Son of God, how much impact does he really have? How seriously do I take? We paddle around with the shallows, can't we? We're just throwing out jargon here and there and just being satisfied with the status quo. Sometimes we can even say ourselves, can't we? Well, perhaps I will start taking Jesus a little bit more seriously when I just get through this stage in my life. And it's the same excuses, when things are a little bit less busy. When work has settled down a little bit, when I've got my career on path a little bit, when I've done my exams. Or when I'm a bit older, I'll enjoy myself. When I'm a bit older, I'll begin to really go for it. Jesus can call me to be a missionary when I'm 32, until then. We're not in control. He's Lord, if he is Lord. And we need to treat him as such and take him seriously as such. Two misjudgments of Jesus. All I see is all there is, and all I plan will come about. But the reality is, look at the end of verse 28. There's the contrast in the two paragraphs here. End of verse 28. The contrast to all I see is all there is verse 28, Jesus' words, you don't know. And the consequence, all I plan will come about. Think of ourselves with that. Well, end of verse 34 and verse 36 is emphasised twice. You cannot come. Two misjudgments that actually have eternal consequences. Being wrong about Jesus, it is serious. Jesus has returned to the Father. We can't follow him unless we acknowledge and submit to him as God's Son, our own King now. Now, he's the one who opens up the future for us, but it means we must trust him now. Now, well, don't be that you're the first time here today, and some of what I said is, oh, hang on, Tim. I just arrived today. I'm a student, and I just started my course. I'm just trying to get my head around whatever it was I'm doing this week. And now can I encourage you to come again next week as we carry on going through John's Gospel? There's no doubt there'll be other people you've already met today. Then actually allow them to draw alongside you. Actually perhaps say to someone that you came with today, look, some of the things that Tim said, they are challenging, and would you just walk with me for a while? The next few weeks, if I do what Tim said and read a bit of John's Gospel, would you be willing to answer any question I've got? That's why we're a church for people who don't go to church. And if you ask how the person sat next to you who is a member of the church, then they really ought to say yes. And it'll frighten them a bit, especially if you come back with some really hard questions, but do it for them. It may well be that actually tonight you have heard this before, you know it to be true. It may well be that you're a Christian and you know that you've been dabbling in the shallows of the Son of God, when in actual fact it's such a deep significance. How can you stay in the shallows without weighing importance of who he is? And maybe tonight, I'm going to take you a little bit more seriously. And I'm going to start tonight. Not tomorrow, tonight. That'd be good, wouldn't it? We're going to sing, and our musicians are going to come out to the front. We're going to sing a song, Befriended. It's a great contrast. I mean, what we've been looking at is a challenge, really, of misjudging Jesus. The great, profound encouragement of taking time to be humble before him is just realising the astonishing truth that the God himself reaches out to us who will misjudge and get things wrong, reaches out to us and extends us the arms of friendship, befriended by the King of the Universe. Those are great words.